Welcome to the 50th episode of my podcast, The Logan Bartlett Show. Thanks everyone for listening in, bearing with us on the episode rebrand and all that stuff for the last 10 days or so. What you're going to hear on this episode is a conversation that I had with Alan Patrickoff. Alan is the founder of Apex Partners, a private equity firm with $60 to $70 billion in assets under management. Alan then, at the age of 73, founded Graycroft Partners, which is a venture and growth firm. And at the age of 85, he founded another venture capital firm, which he talks about in the ageless generation, as they call it, but investing in founders or businesses focused on over 60-year-old, the over 60-year-old population. Alan is a really interesting guy. He went to Burning Man this past year. He ran a marathon last year. He does three events a night. He still gets up every morning and works out. He thinks he's going to live to be 114 years old. And so we had a really fun conversation. I think he was a little confused about why we scheduled as long as we did. And then ultimately we ran out of time. So really fun conversation with one of the original folks in the venture capital community, certainly one of the original people in New York venture capital community. And so trust everyone will enjoy that episode here now.
Alan, thanks for doing this. I'm sitting here today with the legendary Alan Patrickoff, the founder of Apex Partners, a now $70 billion asset under management private equity firm, founder of Graycroft, a $2 billion AUM venture capital and growth firm, and then now most recently the founder of Primetime Partners, which raised a $50 million fund, what, 2 years ago?
Be 3 years in May.
You said that there's no like distinction. You've won awards and you get to be Sir if you're in London, right? But you just get the name legendary is sort of what's been bestowed upon you.
I've been stuck with that, though. 2 years ago, I was awarded the Legion d'honneur by the French government.
For starting France or the French venture capital ecosystem,
in 1982. Right?
And so now, does any title come along with that or no?
No, you just have a certificate. And, you know, if you're Sir somebody, if you're in England, you pretty easy to get a restaurant reservation.
With a Sir.
Yeah, I don't know about Legion d'honneur getting your reservation in France, but here it's meaningless.
And you founded Apex at 37, 1970?
1970, was formed as Alan Patrickoff Associates. And I then, in the U.S., in New York, and then Los Angeles, I'm sorry, in Palo Alto. And then in 1977, I made an agreement and joined some guys in London and Paris, and we launched our first fund in Europe in 1981 and 82. And then we changed the name at almost, I think, 1989 to Apex, which was Alan Patrickoff Associates. The X was for Cross Border, which was first adopted in Europe, and then we changed the name here, and it was to kind of have a generic name because we were in 12 countries by then.
Wow. And and then Graycroft you founded in 2006 at the age of 73, and then Primetime you founded 2 years ago at the age of 85.
Around that.
And you're also the author of a book, No Red Lights, Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital and Never Driving Alone, which we'll talk a little bit about.
I hope we'll talk a lot about it.
Lessons we're going to talk through a bunch of different things related to what you teach in there. I'll make sure to leave some on the bone for people to go back and read all of that. But it's a fascinating book and sort of hearing the longitudinal perspective of the venture industry. And it's not just about investing or for founders. I think there's a lot of life lessons in there, right, as well. So we'll talk about that. But investor in a number of successful companies. So I'll ask you about that as well. And you've been active in politics, investor in Hamilton, right? Active in investing in the theater, so a bunch of cool stuff. But and then I guess most recently, attended Burning Man and ran a marathon, what, last year?
Yeah, seems like yesterday, November.
It's crazy. So I think that in researching and prepping for all this, the single thing that I understood the least about all your life and all of these things. I mean, it's obviously you've founded a number of venture firms. You've had financial success. You've been associated with a number of interesting projects along the way. You triple book yourself three nights a week? You triple book yourself every night in terms of going out from an event standpoint?
You know, that may be a little bit overstated. I don't deliberately overbook.
But you're willing to pack in your calendar with social events.
Yeah, exactly. I figure out how to make most things work, even during the day, not just in the evening. But it's, you learn the techniques of how to do it. But they're, whether they're a podcast or whether it's a theater or whether it's a cocktail party or a dinner party, there's a way of balancing.
But 7 days in the week, you are doing something outside of your home at night, all seven?
Well, that's, not all seven, but pretty much.
At the age of 88, though. Yeah. And then you're getting up 5 days a week and working out with a trainer or doing running and all of that. Is this always been, have you always been this active and on the go and all that? I'm 35 years old, and it sounds exhausting to me, your schedule now.
Yeah, I've always been I always have been the first person in the office. And I used to be the last person leaving. I don't do that quite as intensely as I did years ago, because I just don't have the reason to be in there at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and I have other things that I'm doing.
What's your any trick, or is it coffee, is it some drug that you've discovered that the rest of us don't have, or is this sort of the way you
it's
are?
Just I'm built, I guess my internal rhythm works that way, and I manage to do it. It's been part of my life. And of course, in addition to that, I've got 3 sons and 7 grandchildren, which I also try to keep in contact with on a really frequent basis.
It's impressive. And I know you have, you're going to live to 114 at least, right? So you have a number of years.
That's my objective.
Yeah. It's a good mission to have. But, so you recently wrote a book. You started writing it at 85, 86, something like that?
A little bit before, I started Primetime, and it was during, before COVID, maybe the summer before everything kind of hit the fan. And I just thought it was time that I put some reflections on paper. And the way I write is the way I live. I did it like a stream of consciousness. I sat down and on yellow lined paper in my terrible left-handed handwriting, I just started writing what I remembered and what I could think about. So it was not in a logical progression. I was born at, and I did, but it goes all over the place. And I was fortunate enough to get a editor researcher to help me at a later date. And I think the title was my title, No Red Lights, Never Driving Alone. And she took that Never Driving Alone idea very cleverly. Because I go from politics to theater investing to classic cars to working for the president of Nigeria, and of course having run 3 venture firms,
being at Stephen Talkhouse in Montauk,
So she constructed the chapters. And I took a left turn, I took a right turn, I took a U turn, and it's all in driving metaphors, which I thought was fabulous because it you don't think of that about. You're talking about venture capital, and all of a sudden you're in the theater.
Yeah.
And then back to politics, and then back to venture capital. So from my standpoint, I'm very happy with that kind of chapter headings.
And it was laid out pretty linearly of your life, right, from a time period standpoint. And each chapter sort of has some distinctive elements around it. When you were writing it, did you have a end market of who would appreciate it in mind, or were you just sort of coming in from, hey, here's my life and whoever enjoys it will enjoy it?
Well, I think you're asking a really good question because it's what motivated me to do this in the first place. I said to myself, I'm not an author. What right do I have even to write a book? And I wrote it for a bifurcated audience. And honestly, it has succeeded exactly the way I wanted. I wanted to write it, first of all, for your friends, maybe even younger than you. And I have observed a lot of young people that I came in contact with, mentees of mine over the years and people in all professions. And I felt there was an awful lot of single-mindedness around if you're a lawyer, writing briefs and writing them till midnight. If you're a investment banker doing spreadsheets through the weekend and not really spending a lot of time in tasting the opportunities that either were presented to them or that they could go after. And what I pride myself, and I think all the things you said earlier are my life, is I have either grabbed opportunities that I saw going in front of me or I've gone after them at no red lights. And that's the way I live my life, looking and trying to taste the opportunities we have. I've lived a very, very full life. So I wanted to inspire, to some degree, younger people. And I have had enough feedback to know that whether it's just younger people themselves or parents who had kids in their 20s or 30s who said, I sent this to my kids, and I sent it to, you know, someone that seemed to me they got it. The other audience was I was really struck by the fact that several of the people I know had been either retiring or forced to retire because of internal rules. For example, Apex requires you to retire at 60. Hmm. It didn't affect me because I left in my 70s, but I was a little bit
grandfathered
in. But I didn't set that rule. My successors did. I think it's short-sighted because I think someone at 60 has got the best Rolodex, lots of energy, knows their field probably better than anybody. And I wanted to say, you know, if you're in the paint business, go back in the paint business again. You've got an edge over someone who's 25 who wants to just start a new paint company, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Or become a poet or become a writer or do something. And so I wanted to inspire people to, when they were older, to say, don't just go down to Florida, play golf, go fishing. And of all the people who've given me feedbacks, and it's not in the reviews of the book necessarily on Amazon, but I ran into a fellow in my apartment building who's lived there as I have for many, many years. And I ran into him a few weeks ago, and he said, Alan, I loved your book. I sent it to my kids, I sent it to my grandchildren, and I've sent it to my friends. He said, it's just terrific. He said, the only thing I'm upset about, and by the way, he's 80 years old. He's a member of the New York Stock Exchange. He said, the only thing I'm upset about is I wish I had read it 20 years ago. And to me, that was the best review I could possibly have. So he was saying, I've been sitting at my desk watching ticker tapes, and I really could have done a lot more things in these last 20 years that I haven't done. And
it's interesting when you talk about that, the younger generation, my generation or whatever, the perspective of the breadth, right? And then the older generation, there's kind of this this picking a period in the future and sort of thinking about your cumulative experiences and continuing to work towards some time that all these things benefit, right? You talk about the cumulative experience that builds up and stuff. I guess a question as that relates to the venture capital industry to some extent, you've clearly done a fantastic job of continuing to iterate and think through new markets and all of that stuff. One of the pushbacks something that it has become a platitude in the industry is like it's a young man's game, right, to some extent. Like, you know, it's hard to be out there meeting founders and having the nimbleness of thought to think through new markets and all of that stuff, right?
Well, how many people over, I'll say 60 or even over 50 are sitting in the waiting room with venture capitalists? Not very many.
Not many, right? And so I guess a question of that is how have you been able to keep that, like there's obviously the breadth of experience, but we live in a very nimble industry, right? It's not industrial manufacturing that is mostly the same as it was 10 years ago. How have you been able to mentally sort of continue to benefit from both the cumulative advantages that come with experience, but also stay nimble to new ideas and all of that?
No red lights.
Yeah.
I mean, going to conferences, attending meetings, talking to people on your left or your right, wherever you go, experiencing life. I do not set myself forth as the leading technologist. I am not. In fact, just the opposite. I do have a pretty good insight in how young businesses get formed, get built, and how they grow. And that's really my contribution. But I pick up enough along the way that I can sit and intelligently hear a presentation and react to it. And I keep myself current. I read everything, whether it's newspapers or magazines or online material, not necessarily three every night, but, doing things. And that's where you keep yourself relevant. I say this all the time to friends. If I went to work and went in at 10 and left at 3, I would no longer be relevant in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You have to be, really in it if you're going to be in it.
And I get the feeling from the latitudinal perspective of like the breadth of things that you were able to or have been able to continue to intertwine. Hey, I'm doing theater over here, but I'm going to bring that in and sort of think about how that impacts the venture industry or the lessons learned from that. You became friends with David Stern, the NBA commissioner, and brought him into meetings right at Greycroft to sort of talk through things like that. And so I get the feeling that all these things for you kind of intertwined, and there probably wasn't work and then life. The lines probably blended a little bit. But can you talk a little bit about like how the intertwining, not just from leading a full life and not defining yourself solely by your career, but were there little benefits of concentric circles that kind of mapped together as you did this and then brought it over to learn or help in that?
I'll go back to a comment you made, which is in the book. Everything in life is cumulative.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's really what I would tell you. What, people you met along the way, experience you have, reflections on those, and continuing to learn and do. I mean, for example, which you're not aware of, I just was appointed by President Biden to go on the Securities Investors Protection Corporation, SIPC. It protects your brokerage account like the FDIC protects your bank deposits. And I got there because I like being involved on some basis in what's going on in Washington. I found that a very interesting part of my life. And I had no interest in being an ambassador or taking a job, but I did want to do something that was relevant to my world, although I'm not in the public stock market, but I certainly know a hell of a lot about it. And so now I will be going down to Washington for board meetings 6 times a year. And I think that's the way I've lived all my life is, take advantage of opportunities, do interesting things, and they all intersect in some way.
Well, there's a bunch of different threads in the book that I think are interesting to go down, and I'll leave it for people to read all of them on their own. But another thing I wanted to touch on from it is, I think it was 1966 to 1969 in your life. It sounded like a very unique, fun period where you were an investor in a nightclub.
I started
a nightclub.
Yeah.
You were a bachelor in New York, living where?
Divorced in east side of Manhattan.
East side of Manhattan, owning a nightclub. You went to Woodstock went to Woodstock, maybe got
broke down on the New York State
Thruway. Did you know at the time, by the way, was Woodstock known, obviously not to the extent it was today, but was it really a big deal at the time and everyone was trying to go?
In hindsight, it was bigger than what it was time. But
I can't imagine you expected we would still be talking about it 50 years later.
Yeah, no, never.
Yeah.
And frankly, from what I know now about Woodstock, and having broken down at, exit 16 on the thruway, which was before the Woodstock exit, I probably would have been backed up for 10 miles.
Sure.
And I probably would have been sitting in my car all night in a blinding rainstorm. So I probably never would have gotten there. Anyhow.
And it probably was, I'm sure the people in their minds now remember it as like the best experience ever. It probably was a little unpleasant just how many people were there and the weather that. It remembers with this line.
But it's great to have. I trade on the fact that I almost
went. That's right.
I also, more importantly at that time, I was chairman of the board of New York Magazine. I formed it in 1967.
So maybe that's a good segue into, I want to talk about that period in your life just because it seems like a really cool, interesting time in New York. But so your father immigrated from Ukraine as an orphan at 4 years old, moved to Ohio.
Yeah.
And then how did he end up? He ended up in New York.
Everybody ends up in New York.
Yeah,
his brother came here first and he followed him.
And then he was in the remnant business, right. And then became a stockbroker.
Exactly.
And you were living on where?
West side of New York.
Just for people that, I've lived here for the last, whatever, plus or minus 10 years. What was New York? How would you describe it at the time growing up on the upper West Side?
It was a very personal, more informal basis, as I have said. You know, you still had, I mean, I don't want to make myself like an antiquarian, but I mean, there was still an ice truck that came down
sure.
the street. There was still coal chutes. And there was a lot of, as a young kid, playing on the streets. And, you know, Central Park was our front yard or backyard, however you want. And there was a real interaction with the city. I went to school by subway. I used to ride my bike all over the city. Today, forget about the bike riding today is a different kind of bike experience. You're not doing it where you go visit your friend on a bike. You're getting city bike to go to work or something.
But sure.
It was like living in the suburbs or like living in a small town.
Yeah, it was closer to that. Interesting. And so then you ended up at going to Horseman, a well-known prep school here in New York, and then found your way to Ohio State, which wasn't exactly a pipeline, right?
I hadn't planned to go there.
You almost went to Brandeis and maybe.
Well, you really have read the book.
I told you I prepped for this. You asked how we were going to talk this long, and I said I was going to do a bunch of prep. So you almost went to Brandeis, which was a new school at the time, right? And then ended up finding your way to Ohio State,
yeah.
which was not the plan, right?
I went through in 3 years and did pretty well. And I was able to move quickly because I had a lot of advanced courses because of Horace Mann courses that I had taken that made me qualified for credits quicker.
Hey,
I want to go back for a second.
Yeah,
because you talked about 66 to 70.
Yeah.
I always talk about this, which is not great for my current activities, but those were my most exciting days, because if you you have to understand, this was the time of the Beatles. It was the time music was terrific. Fashion was front and center. And I had, here is running the leading magazine in the city, having this nightclub in Southampton for the summers. And I being having just gotten divorced, I was in a very interesting position.
Very social.
And yeah, and it was a fun time. It was
you were 33 to 37-ish
in
that period?
30. Yeah.
What is a nightclub in 1968?
This particular one was a unique one, which is actually in the history books, not because of me. I backed a guy named Bobby Goldstein, who's still alive. Spells his name B-O-B-B, Bob Goldstein, and a guy named Joshua White, which formed something called the Joshua Light Show, which is still actually operating and travels around the country. And Josh and Bob had this idea of a different concept of a multimedia discotheque. It was a discotheque more than a nightclub.
What's the distinction you're drawing there?
I don't know. Just, nightclub means something different to me.
Yeah, okay.
It was a discotheque, and it had the crystal ball.
That's what I picture.
It was one of the first, if not the first, I don't know that for sure.
Where was it?
In Southampton
it
on
was.
North Sea Road. And it had projections of videos and stills coming from two corners, which was very crude.
Onto
when
the
you look
wall.
Back,
or...
I mean, using slide projectors
and
16-millimeter movie projector.
Was someone actually going in and swapping out different...
I wasn't.
Yeah,
someone was.
Yeah, that's
Bob, probably Bobby and Josh.
And being the chairman of the New York Magazine, I guess, what would you equate that to today for someone? Just, I mean, it was a big deal, right? New York Magazine was sort of a cultural center?
It was how to live in New York. I mean, you did... Everybody subscribed to it who lived, certainly, in the Manhattan world
sure.
of... whatever was happening. I mean, it was the, if you want, it was the subtitle was How to Survive Better in New York.
So yeah.
I don't know if there is equivalent today. Yeah. Honestly, I don't know. You know, Rolling Stone came after that.
Sure.
I don't know what's the, you tell me, what's the equivalent
today? I was trying to think of like Lorne Michaels and SNL, but you know, or something like that. But
SNL's been around about as long.
Yeah, I was just thinking, but in the early days of the 70s, whatever that, yeah. If it was.
It was a very exciting time in the whole country. I mean, it was, I don't think New York in particular, but it was, as I say, a time of music and fashion.
Totally.
And, you know, things were exciting.
Yeah, and you had some amazing writers as well, right? On staff with there. So but that wasn't how you. So you came back from Ohio State.
I did not create New York Met. It was created by a guy named Clay Felker. I was the chairman of the board that put together the financing.
So you came back from Ohio State, and you were an econ major, finance major.
Yeah, finance.
And you rode the elevator up and down. What building was it? Just going in and asking people for...
Every building.
Every building, okay. No,
but I started at 120 Wall Street and ended up getting a job at 63 Wall Street.
Just and going in to every floor and asking if there was a job available.
No, there were no one was recruiting out in Ohio, and there wasn't the same kind of headhunting activities for young analysts that exist today. And you had no online.
Yeah, no online. I guess the equivalent would be sending tons of, I don't know, cold emails or something, cold calling today.
I'm sure did that too. I'm sure I sent out plenty of resumes.
To letters and how long did it take you to...
Which had to be typed by hand.
Yeah. How long did it take you to find a job?
Took me from June or July to September.
Okay. So
3 months.
Yeah.
3 months beating.
You graduated early, so you already had a schedule in that regard. And so you found your way into finance, and that was a wealth management-ish type thing. And so you were helping people pick stocks and manage the portfolio and all that stuff there.
Traditional investment portfolio.
And so how'd you find your way into venture launching your first fund in 1970?
Well, I got recruited. I mean, I recruited. Someone suggested me to another firm, which was doing what they called development capital, which was doing projects, a finance company in Canada, a telecontrol company in Michigan, trying to build a bridge across a river in Portugal. So there were projects. And
why was someone, I mean, why would they do that? Did they just think, hey, there could be good investment returns here? Yeah, and they were just...
I'm sure they're exact... firms existing today
that are
working on projects and developments. And, you know, it's one step. It wasn't public stocks. It was one step closer to just doing private. We were not doing venture deals.
Yeah.
And then from there, you know, after a stint in the Army, two stints in the Army, I did, I was recruited by a friend of mine from Goldman Sachs, who suggested I meet these people at this family wealth management firm, and went there, which was running one family's money, not mine. And in the course of doing that, in addition to primarily a public portfolio, they were offered frequently opportunities to participate in private deals. And I was the only one in this organization that had an interest in this private sometimes startup, sometimes later stage investments. And so that gravitated me more and more into the private deal, which I found much more fun, exciting, interesting.
Why was that? Just because you could help more? Or?
Because I felt in the public market, I'd wake up one day and the market was down 20% or 2% and the stocks would go down, and I had no, you know, I was like a victim.
Yeah.
Whereas in a private company, I kind of was involved. I knew what was happening. There were surprises, but they were kind of different surprises. And I felt more intimately involved. And that, to me, seemed like a more exciting future.
Yeah. And so 1970, you decide, are you making a conscious decision, hey, I'm going to go launch my own venture fund?
Yeah.
What was it called at the time?
Alan Patricov Associates.
No, but what was the industry? I mean,
I don't, you know, it's interesting. I don't think it was called venture capital. I think it was development capital.
Development capital.
Yeah, I think so. I can't prove it. I mean, the National Venture Capital Association was formed in 73 or 74. So, you know, and there were firms around. I don't know the exact date. You'd have to look it up. But whether Kleiner Perkins was there then, I know Warburg Pincus was in operation because I knew Lionel, who had started that. And there were
Sequoia probably started a couple of years later. Venrock was
Venrock had started the family groups. Venrock, J.H. Whitney, Bessemer. They were in operation. They were the precursor, you might say, of a venture industry.
Yeah.
They were the ones who were. If anyone were doing deals and different parts of investment banking firms, whether it was Lehman Brothers or Loeb Broads or Wertheim, they had not Morgan Stanley and not Goldman Sachs. They weren't in this area yet, but partners at these other more entrepreneurial partnership type firms were taking flyers, if you will, in early stage deals.
And so you raised $2.5 million. Who was that from? High net worth individuals?
People I had met over years in all these preceding activities. And I also had 9 clients who paid me an annual retainer. So I didn't have just the $2.5 million.
For like wealth management services or?
Yeah, I said to a family managed office, look, you have your public portfolio. In case you get any private deals, send them to me and I'll vet it for you. Or if I see any, I'll send them to you pre-vetted.
Got it.
And so that's, I had 9 clients.
Co-invest, of co-invest.
Yeah, plus this kitty of $2.5 million.
How long did it take you to raise that? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Probably not that long. Because it wasn't that big. But, you know, to get 9 clients was not the simplest thing to get them to pay $25,000 a year for a 2-year contract for an idea.
Yeah.
But they knew me. I don't remember getting any people I had not known.
The state of the industry, it sounds like industry might be very loosely defined at that point, but we touched on some of the names there. Were you aware of Kleiner Perkins on the West Coast and Warburg Pincus at this time? And like, were you collaborating at all, or was it just everything was so distinct?
Modestly, that increased as the years went on. But when I started day one, I actually, the only firm I think I was aware of was Allstate Insurance had an operation in Chicago run by a guy named Ned Heiser, who I always think of as a precursor of a lot of these firms. But the venture industry technically was started by a guy named General Dorio.
Yeah, sure.
Frenchman who taught at Harvard, who started his American research and development in 1946. But that was, you know, it was an isolated operation up in Boston.
It took a little while to get going. And so the industry then, it sort of grew up over the course of the next couple years, right? As you think about the moments in time, as you sort of reflect on what's now become a pretty institutionalized industry, I was thinking about it in terms of decades, right? The 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. But I imagine in your mind, there's probably more different lines of demarcation, right? To some extent, when the NBCA got launched, when was it 1978 that institutions were allowed to start investing?
76, I think.
76. And so those are probably big. And then there's the PC revolution, right? I'm sure for you, some of the media changes that happened along the way, obviously the internet bubble and all of that stuff. How do you sort of think about the periods of time of venture? And how do you draw demarcations in terms of the big changes that occurred?
Well, I don't think of it like you're expressing, but if I had to, I'd say, you know, the PC revolution of the 80s, the cellular field, which was really important, mobile communication was a big deal.
Yeah.
And then the internet of probably let's say the 90s. I mean, and I guess we're now living in the AI world.
We were in the crypto world a year ago, so who knows?
I've stayed away from crypto.
I know. So, I want to ask you. I want to ask you about that in a second. But as you sort of think about the asset class growing up, one of the things that I reflected on was Apex, which you started, Warburg, TA, sort of some of the East Coast firms grew up into essentially private equity firms, right? And then there was a handful of other ones on the East Coast, CRV, Greylock, that have effectively moved into West Coast firms. And what we think of today as at least that vintage of venture capital firms that still exist are mostly West Coast firms, the ones that like persisted as venture firms. Does that have something to do with like the geographical centricity of, hey, there weren't as many Apples or Microsofts or Amazons or whatever it was, Google's on the East Coast. And so some of these businesses, I mean, private equity can be a much more scalable asset class than venture can. And so in some ways you could argue it's a better business. But what do you think the East Coast firms kind of grew up into a lot of private equity firms?
I always say my friends at Apex, they'll make more money in one investment than a venture firm will do in a whole fund.
Oh, yeah. It's listen, managing or having $70 billion AUM or whatever, the math pencils out pretty well.
The private equity business is a financial engineering, discounted cash flows, present value calculations, and a very competitive business, much more so than venture. I mean, people are competing for deals. Everything gets put out to multiple people.
It's zero sum for the most part. You're not collaborating.
Yeah.
There's no co-invest. I mean, sometimes there is.
Everybody's trying to compete with each other. The highest price usually wins. Venture is a much more independent, not as organized. You know, that's why there are so many venture firms.
Yeah.
There must be thousands. Every day someone leaves a firm and starts another venture firm. So I think that the truth is that there is the technology world really formed itself in and around Fairchild, Fairchild Engineering in Northern California, and company venture firms were spawned, startups were spawned from that base. Really, there was a base, there people have done maps of how those companies.
Yeah, the derivatives from
exactly. And we don't have that in the East Coast. And it's, you know, people have bemoaned this fact for many, many years that there wasn't technology. Today, so many of these major companies all have some presence here, whether it's Google or Amazon or Facebook or Microsoft. Everybody's got a big presence on the East Coast. So there's more likely to be technology startups here. You know, will it get bigger than the West Coast? I doubt it, but certainly it's happening. Also, the venture business was primarily Boston and somewhat New York and Northern California. When I started Greycroft with my two partners, Dana Settle and Ian Sigalow, we opened up in Los Angeles, and of course we're in New York. And I would say to you today, Los Angeles is a major factor in the venture industry. I'd say that New York, many of the West Coast firms have opened up here. NEA's opened up here. I believe Sequoia may have opened up here. So I haven't.
Index just opened up here.
You know, they obviously feel they've got to be in this area. I think Boston has declined because Boston got mostly medical firms. I mean, Greylock moved out of Boston. Charles River moved. They probably may have some presence still in Boston. So, and then you have my friend Steve Case, who's going around the country with Revolution, rightly saying that there's startups every place, and there's technology every place, and there's creative entrepreneurial people in Keokuk, Iowa. Yep. People should be nurturing these companies, whether it's local money or national money. Greycroft has, you know, prided itself in investing all over the country. I mean, I was very active at Greycroft in a company in Minneapolis. We had another company in Nashville and Columbus, Ohio. I mean, we've So I think that the industry is much more diffused today. Although at the end of the day, the core, the heart of technology is still Silicon Valley.
The industry as it grew, or Apex as it grew up, right, and started to become more.
It was Alan Patrickov Associates till it changed the name. So really the first almost 20 years was Alan Patrickov Associates. And then when we started promoting a new name, which worked perfectly.
And so from 1970 to 1987 or whatever, yeah. Alan Patrickov Associates, then Apex after that, how initially it was development capital, and then it sort of the venture was institutionalized. Along the way, at some point, it started to be a little bit more private equity, as you touched on. When did that shift start happening? And
about, well, it was probably in the 90s.
And Sunglass Hut and a few other investments.
Well, Office Depot was earlier, but we were, you know, let's face it, people would rather work on substantive numbers as opposed to theoretical market extrapolations, which is, you know, it's putting up your finger to the wind. I mean, no one knows how a lot of these young companies will develop. And Primetime Partners, my new firm, focuses on early stage seed and early stage, and most of the companies are year, 2-3 years old, and not a lot of financial substance or analysis that you can deal with. You've got to deal with what you think the opportunities are in the market they're addressing.
Yeah, I want to talk about Primetime in a second, but so Apex scaled up, and after the internet bubble, you decided it sort of became a private equity firm.
Yeah, it was I didn't enjoy that as much as being involved with early stage companies.
And so then you took off a couple years from venture investing and did some political related stuff.
No, I did mostly international. I worked in international development. I went as a pro bono for the World Bank and the IFC. I went on a couple of nonprofit boards, which were involved in entrepreneurial development abroad. And then I got appointed by Democratic appointment in the Bush administration to go on something of the board of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which was involved in international new concepts in our foreign aid. And, I did that and it was a very exciting time. And then I happened to meet the president of Nigeria and got involved with his presidential advisory council. So I, no red lights.
Yeah, you were very active through that period. But what made you decide to start another firm after, I guess, 5-6 years?
Because I saw that things had settled down in the venture business. I didn't think what I was doing was enough for me. I felt I had so much energy still in me that why not do it again?
Yeah.
And so I started out what I hoped would be a pure venture firm. I think Graycroft has morphed into a venture and growth fund firm today. I wouldn't call it a private equity firm. I wanted to do something again. I started up and found a couple of other people who agreed with me and opened offices. And today, as of last week, I think they have 65 people working at Graycroft.
Wow. And so then, so that was 2006 to 2018, 19. You started to do a transition out of Graycroft. You officially left last year, but started to talk about it with the partners.
I guess it's about 3 years.
3 years. And was that a similar, the capital was kind of scaling and it started to be a little bit of a different business?
No, had nothing to do with that. Yeah. It's just that we were becoming a bigger firm, more administrative aspects. And I just felt when I had two all-star partners and I worked at a 4-year transition. So it wasn't like I dropped in and I've done several deals.
You did Axios during that period of time.
Yeah, and I've
done
Wondery and I've done a whole bunch of podcast companies. And I, without a specific date, I'm not doing any new deals for Graycroft anymore by my own interest. The last The last deal I did was about a year ago, the last new deal that I put in the portfolio with the approval of the whole partnership was a very interesting company in the government procurement area.
Oh, cool. And so then you but you had another act in you, and you started Primetime Partners. So what was the impetus to do that?
It was the same impetus. Well, it was a combo. One was the book as I was writing it. Number two was I was reading a lot of stuff about what the population trends were, and I kept reading that, you know, the population for those people over 60 by 2030 would be bigger than those under 18. I saw all the venture money running into dog walking and fast delivery companies. And the more I read about what was happening, and at the same time, my wife was very ill with Alzheimer's, so I saw all the needs there were for older people. And as I say, I saw a lot of my friends retiring, and I started thinking about this is a whole market that is really not being adequately addressed. And I had been on the board of Thrive Global, which was Arianna Huffington's company dealing with wellness. And one day my son said to me, you know, Abby Levy, who was the founding president with Arianna of Thrive Global and who I would see at board meetings every 3 months, he said he had gone to Harvard Business School with her, and he said, you know, Abby Levy is thinking of the same thing you've been thinking, except that she's going to do something about it, and you're just talking about it. You ought to get together. So we got together 2 days later, no red lights, and within a few weeks, we formed a firm, and I came up with the name Primetime Partners, which was, I'm living in my prime time now. I think everybody over 60 is in their prime time. You know, think about this. If I'm right about living to 114, we'll see if I am. At 60, you just about lived half your life. So you got the second half to go. So make the most of it. So we had a similarity of interests. Abby was more interested in the product and services aspect. I was more interested in the older entrepreneur opportunities for backing people, but there was a definite confluence of interest, and so we just did it.
So those are the two.
Just as COVID was starting,
and so those are the two areas: is services and products and content technology related to the generation, and then also older founders people, the generation. Oh, I didn't realize
founders on it. Not necessarily servicing the old elderly,
but founders that are of that generation.
Anyone who's got a good idea, our waiting room will give you a seat.
Oh, interesting. I didn't appreciate both sides of that. So from an investment standpoint, now that's a $50 million fund that you're currently investing out of, and it's $1,500,000 investments that, and then you'll scale over.
I think
time.
We got a couple of $2 million investments, but we've also got a couple of $250,000 investments.
You've been pretty vocal, I guess, investment style. I've heard you talk about that not every business should be venture funded, and there's different types of capital. And now, you know, power law and swinging for the fences and the fund sizes that are commiserate with entrepreneurs going big or going home, right?
The Reid Hoffman concept.
The Reid Hoffman, blitzscaling, all of that stuff. I get the feeling that I've heard you be much more measured, both in terms of your approach, right, that you can, hey, some of those podcast investments you've done have been fantastic IRRs and good cash-on-cash returns, but not huge absolute dollar.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I've built a lot of my reputation on a lot of successful media related investments, whether it was Audible or Cellular Communications or Lynn Broadcasting. I've done a lot of in the media era. And I did it when I was at Alan Patrick of Associates. We did it when we were called Apex. We did it at Grey Crowd. We're not doing that in primetime, not yet. But Grey Crowd has decided that they really don't want to do new media investments. That did not affect my change in status, but I'm more logically, from that standpoint, interested in putting in media investments into Grey Crown. But they said just what you did. Let's face it, I don't think there's been any media deal that's had a resolution of more than $500 million.
Axios is probably the biggest one.
The biggest.
Right? Yeah.
So you can't shoot for the fences. You're not going to get a $10 billion exit. I mean, BuzzFeed is a perfect example.
Yeah.
You know, one time they thought that was $1.6 billion. I don't know what the valuation would be today. So I think media is just not getting the multiples or the interest, and probably properly so.
What would you say to entrepreneurs that maybe in media or not, or the industry at large, about the need to swing for the fences with these fund sizes and all that? And do you think that there just needs to be different financial products and fund sizes that generating $100 million acquisition is fantastic, right? And is it something that structurally the industry has just moved too far to this expectation that, hey, if it's not multi-billion dollar, then it's not worth it?
I mean, look, that's the prevalence of thinking today. When I started Greycroft, specifically in our first presentation pitch deck, it said we're looking for small investments and we're looking at realistic outcomes that don't depend on a public market and that, you know, can make money at $100 million or $200 million that don't require a $1 billion exit. So many larger size funds, there is a inclination, not a necessity, to put larger amounts of money into a deal and to shoot for higher outcomes. I don't think necessarily that it's going to work that way, but based on some of the valuations that have occurred, if they don't have that kind of outcome, they're going to have a lot of long holding periods and very short outcomes.
Yeah. In terms of your investment approach to working with companies, you also, I think in the early days of Greycroft, said, hey, we're not going to take board seats. We'll take observer seats. Yeah. What was the philosophy behind that?
Well, I learned from, at that time, whatever number of years I'd been in the business, that in every instance, as a venture investor, you had a minority position. You had control through the contract you wrote. So the contract had provisions for borrowing and for salary changes and all those things. But it wasn't because you had a board seat. So, and I knew that every venture firm that I knew would insist on having a board seat because they wanted to show their limited partners we're a valuated investor. Yeah. And we take a board seat on every company we're in, implying that they had ability to influence the outcome. And I realized that board seat didn't mean a damn thing. If you're a private equity investor, it does mean something. If you're a leveraged buyout, because you have more than 41%, so you really kind of are you're the owner. But when you go into an early stage deal and you're a minority position, it's probably going to be the second or third round, fourth round, if you have to have it, that the control aspects of the board are going to count. So I said, why not make yourself venture friendly to other firms and say to any other firm, you can have the board seat. We'll be an observer. And, you know, sometimes there are two venture firms vying for seats. Both of you can be. And we don't have to be the lead. You can be the lead.
And you'll use your soft diplomacy anyway to be effective. Yeah.
Sitting at the board, you can speak and have your
influence
say and influence outside the meeting. But you don't have the vote. And you don't serve on the audit committee or the compensation committee. And I had learned that that's not a bad position to be in. And it's entrepreneurs love the idea. When we first started saying, you don't want a board seat. You're the only person we've talked to who doesn't want a board seat. And in many cases, it made you more attractive because they didn't have to deal with people fighting for board seats.
The differentiator. Yeah, well, now it's sort of come back in the news with all the FTX stuff that's played out. But from a market standpoint, I guess this ties into crypto at large. Like, how have you thought, you stayed out of crypto, now we're in AI, you've seen the internet, you saw mobile and cellular, you saw the PC revolution. And I guess as you see these markets, how do you determine what's speculative, right, and maybe not going to persist versus what you stayed out of crypto? Like, what was it in crypto specifically that you said, hey, this maybe isn't for me or not interesting?
I came to that conclusion a little differently. I decided, this is one time where age had an impact. I said, crypto is a whole new language, and I've got to learn a whole new set of words and phrases.
You have to tweet GM is what they do in the morning. Yeah.
And I said, I really don't feel like learning it.
Got it.
So when I get asked all the time, like in podcasts like this or in person, what's your opinion of podcasts? I say the same thing. You know, I don't want to pontificate because I am not experienced.
You haven't gotten into it.
But I stayed out of it.
Yeah.
I can't tell you my three sons haven't done it, but that they've done that independently.
Yeah, got it. Interesting.
Like everybody else.
This sort of backs up to the point about investing in returns for venture scale companies versus not. But entrepreneurialism has been very much in vogue over the course of the last, I mean, particularly the last 10 years, I think, sort of post-social network. I feel like there was definitely a, and the money's been so plentiful. You speak at business schools and will often ask the audience how many people plan to go into entrepreneurialism. What, in terms of evaluating founders, what do you actually look for? Like those people that are listening that are in business school or whatever, and they say, oh yeah, I want to go be a founder. I want to start a company. What should they be asking themselves if it's a good idea or not? And when should they go? Should they do it right out of business school? Should they go learn under someone to get experience on someone else's dime? How do you think about
it? You know, it's different for each person, but I believe that unfortunately, there are a lot of businesses that are being started by people, particularly out of business school or whatever school or no school.
You went to business school, I didn't, so you can make fun of it.
Yeah. No. But I think that it feeds on itself because they see someone from a previous class or someone they know who started a business and who on paper is worth a lot of money or maybe really made money. And so they want to emulate them. And so they want to start something. And I think that there's not enough attention given to, you know, is this a good business? The address market I'm going after, do I know it? Do I know something about it? Have I really analyzed what the opportunities are of where I'm going? Do they understand the economics of that business and what it takes to make a profit? Are they passionate about it? I mean, you know, another one who starts a dog walking company, I don't mean to beat on dog walking, but, you know, is that something you're passionate about? It, but if I met somebody, I don't care whether they came out of business school or whatever, who talks about the market they're going into with real specificity and experience, hopefully, maybe only a little bit, but some experience, where they understand what it takes to make a profit, you know, what a gross margin is and what the costs are to get to that market, where they really care about it and have something to bring to the party, and where hopefully, if possible, they bring some differential in terms of some proprietary advantage. I mean, that would be the most exciting kind of business, as opposed to someone who comes in with a business plan who has no experience in it and who has decided to go into that business.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found is asking yourself, well, one, why is this market going to happen and for now versus some period in the past, right? But then also why you uniquely versus everyone else in the world can help solve this problem. What is the insight you have or the experience you have or the team you're building around or something like that? Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. In terms of, I want to play some of the investments. So outside of being legendary Alan Patricoff, you also are associated with an investment in Apple, right? Which happened pre-IPO as they were going public.
Yeah.
What was the state of the company then? And like what, I know you weren't a early stage venture investor, but it was only a $60 million valuation at whatever, 1.5 times revenue. Yeah. So I think it's close to $2 trillion now. So in the grand scheme of things, you were a very early investor in Apple.
I was, but I don't want to take a lot of credit out of it. What it was is that I had just read a lot of what was going on. I had happened to have bought a TI machine, Texas Instruments machine, for someone's friend of mine whose daughter had just graduated from high school. I knew about Commodore Business Machine, and I had been reading a lot about Apple, and I was just fortuitous that friend of mine who sadly passed away just last week, a guy named Tommy Underberg, who ran a firm called Underberg Tobin, which was probably one of the leading investment banking firms in the technology world. They brought Intel public, and they were part of the Apple syndicate, had a piece of investment available. And I, you know, got very brief opportunity to talk to the company. I can't tell you there was extensive due diligence, but I thought this was an area we wanted to have a participation in, and I had the opportunity. So I don't want to take a lot of credit. I was not a founder. I didn't build a company. I was a lucky investor at the right time.
Is it funny that now has some association, this investment, like of all the ones that you've been super actively involved, like Apple, former or early Apple investor, Alan Patricoff?
I can't go on a CNBC without...
It's a good hook. I mean, maybe we'll do it on our YouTube videos. We'll say early Apple investor, Alan Patricoff.
Every time there's an Apple quarterly report, I get called, and I don't promote it. I tell the truth, but it leads into other things.
Yeah, of course.
It's been very helpful.
Similarly, FedEx was one that you passed on along the way because of what, the capital intensity of the business?
Yeah, I mean, I think I intelligently analyzed it at that time. It was... Stromberg Carlson was involved in it at the time, as I recall. I met with Fred Smith. I had someone who was working with me go down to Nashville, I guess it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Memphis.
Yeah. When I realized what the capital it was going to be required, and we had a small fund, remember, $2.5 million in these nine clients, it was the 1970s, I said, we'll get wiped out after the first round. We won't have any money to keep playing. And it turned out that there were three or four rounds, and anyone who didn't participate got wiped out. And so when it went public, and I can't remember the year it went public, I said, listen, I have all this knowledge and experience in it. At least we're going to buy on the IPO. So we put that in the portfolio, and I think we made 5-10 times on our money. Probably did better than those early stage people, I can
tell
you.
Better be right twice, right? Pick the right timing and be right about all that stuff. What about AOL? So you were
early. AOL, I was early.
Early involved. And it was bought out of bankruptcy?
It was bought out of bankruptcy. It was a game company playing video games online. And it went through bankruptcy. Kleiner had been an investor in it. And Frank Caulfield had a friend who lived in Washington, D.C., where the company was located at that time, who was running restaurants, a guy named Jim Kimsey. And he convinced Jim to go and step in and run this company, taking it out of bankruptcy. And they were trying to raise money. And I was one of two or three people, I think Citigroup, Inco, International Nickel Company Venture, myself and Kleiner, I think, put some more money in, and I got actively involved.
What was the business that was spinning out of the gaming company? Was it the portal?
It was the concept, and I helped because of my relationship at Apple. I did help to get them introduced, and the first service they had was called Apple Link. And then the company was called Quantum Computer. That was the first name coming out of bankruptcy. And then they changed it to America Online. The service became America Online, and the company became America AOL.
What was the peak valuation for AOL at the...
When they sold it to...
No, well, at the top of the internet bubble, like what was it? What was it?
Well, that's when they sold it to AT&T for, I think, $100 billion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was supposed to be, I guess in hindsight, one of the biggest disasters of corporate history in terms of a shrinkage in value.
Yeah, value creation, yeah.
I was not there. I wish I had been there at the time because it was huge value compared to when we went in.
Yeah.
But we did very well as the investment. I got to know Steve Case, who was then at that time marketing vice president of AOL, and then he became president.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Who was running the business, Leontis?
Jim Kimsey.
Oh, Jim Kimsey was. Okay, interesting.
But Steve clearly was, you know, bringing to the fore some, you know, real insights into the whole technology world. His brother was a guy named Dan Case, who was working for Hambrick and Quist on the West Coast. And that's how he got involved in the company, because of Hambricht was involved with Kleiner and
sure, investment banking and all that. Well, I want to end with a few things related to, I guess, doubling back to the book. So,
well, we didn't talk about Primetime.
Oh, I thought.
Well, no, we didn't.
We touched on some. What do you want to hit on Primetime?
Well, I'm just saying, you know, I started Primetime because of the opportunities in this field, and I think this is a burgeoning area.
So, what do you think about the? I mean, obviously, you've lived this experience over the last 28 years. You've been in the Primetime target market, right?
Oh, I didn't think about it that way. Okay.
Yeah. Which. Ironically, I mean, I guess 114, you sort of, the amount of time you've been here is, what uniquely about having a product and a focus on this appealed to you? Obviously, the trends behind it are super impressive, right?
Yeah, I did come to some of this, but we now have 30 investments, and it runs, you know, from caregiving to telemedicine, focused on older people, to consumer products.
What's the percentage of servicing the industry versus older founders?
Oh no, it's mostly
servicing.
We have several older founders in this area.
Oh, they are. Okay.
We don't have any older founder who came to us to start a paint company.
Got it.
Which I'm still waiting for.
Still waiting for the paint company.
But we're like any early stage startup fund. You know, it takes time for these companies to mature. Our half-life is probably a year and a half, because we've made investments, you know, a month ago or last week.
Yeah, totally.
So, and there are several firms that have started up since then who really have identified this area, as we have, as a fast-growing area. And every large firm has now the word longevity or aging someplace in their deck,
sure,
so that, you know, they will do an isolated deal too. But when we started, Abby and I both said we want to become thought leaders in this area, and we really have accomplished it. There are not too many conferences or appearances at events that we don't get an opportunity to present the story. And I would say most companies, we had a meeting with a company this morning, and they want us as an investor because Primetime Partners is identified with this market, and if they're in your cap table, it kind of helps to identify who your market is. And we've really been really very religious. Our portfolio really, every single company services let's say 50 and over. I used to say 60 and over, but certainly the older generation, you don't see the dog walking companies.
Yeah, no dog walking companies in that. Are there, how much of an advantage has it been from an inbound flow standpoint?
Oh,
and
very
brand?
Big.
Is that,
very
is
big.
That the biggest
oh,
advantage
yeah.
of?
Yeah, we're the thought leader. If someone has something in this area, or even a major firm has something, I would hope they'd say, we ought to call Primetime and get them as a co-investor. They don't require a board seat.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't need to be lead, and get them as a participant, and they know something about this market. I mean, clearly, after almost 3 years, we know a lot of what's going on in this market and have a good sense of what would work and what won't work.
So Fund 1 you signed up for, you started in 85, typically 10-plus year cycles,
yeah.
Right? How many more?
And no one asked me whether I would be here at 95 to see the end of the fund, which, by the way, you know, funds don't end in 10 years.
They do not. They typically end up being 12, 14, 15, all that. So it feels like kind of a rude question to ask if you're going to be around at that.
No one asked me.
No one asked you. No. How many more funds do you think you're going to solve back from 114?
One more. Yeah, I think hopefully or possibly we'll do another fund for Primetime 2, maybe sometime later this year. And we'll see if anyone says to me, will you be here in
well, now you've opened the aperture
98,
for
98.
Listen, I don't know. I mean, if
they know me and they heard this podcast and they've looked at my record and they know I'm living to 114, they won't ask the question.
I don't know why they would. If you're doing three events a night and working out 5 days a week, I don't know. I don't know why they would ask that question. It feels like a pretty obvious answer that 114 is pretty attainable for you.
Part of my workout, by the way, is I walk every place, to work, from work, to events. I did not work here today because I've got to drive someplace afterwards.
So I guess in conclusion, as we wrap, one of the things that stuck out the most in the book and in talking to you and all the prep that I did is you you seem very optimistic. I think to be in venture, you probably should be optimistic about things. We're living now in a somewhat nihilistic time period where big tech is under a lot of scrutiny, right? Not to go down a political rabbit hole about this stuff, but big tech and how workers are getting treated and all of this stuff is under more scrutiny than it has been. And I think there's a level of attention that's being put on Silicon Valley and tech, rightfully so, wrongfully so, whatever, not to debate that. But it's a period, and then economically, it's not the best. Politically, I think we're in gridlock. There's obviously a war going on in Ukraine and Russia, right, which I'm sure is personal to you. How do you, among all this stuff, how do you stay optimistic? How do you, obviously it's an innate to you just in general, but how have you been able to maintain over the course of your life such a relentless level of optimism and positivity and just no red lights moving forward and all of this?
I honestly have to lean on the title and keep saying, you know, it's the way I've lived my life. You can't live a life that's no red lights and then have a lot of stoplights preventing you from doing things. Plus, if you're in this business, in the venture business, you have to have a positive attitude and wake up every day in the face of lots of problems, like any, you know, we all have the same thing, and try to overcome them and have a positive point of view. And I really have, every day start that way. I mentioned in the book the fact that I hope every day the elevator door is going to open and the next Steve Jobs is going to walk out. It's living your life in a positive fashion. In effect, say in my activities in primetime, one of the things I liked about the area we're in is that it doesn't have cyclicality. We're going to get more older people, and everyone's going to get older. They're going to need more things. It's relatively inflation resistant. Doesn't all these companies don't have interest? They're so young, they don't borrow money, so they don't have any interest rates. They're not affected by politics. I like this area that we're not as vulnerable as to a traditional firm that's got to worry about, you know, the next thing wiping out their technology or what their, you know, cost of capital is and a whole bunch of things. So I just think that I look on the bright side. I've been through cycles. I've lived through down cycles so many times. And one of the things that in the last couple of years in particular, I've tried to convey to people I work with at Greycroft and Primetime, you know, it's not all going to go one direction and, you know, be tempered in the kind of pricing you have in deals and what your expectations are, to be realistic that, you know, Rose Garden isn't there all the time. So, be careful in what you're doing, be disciplined. And I try very hard to infuse that in what I do.
And that's on the investor side and the perspective you've given at both Primetime and Greycroft. What about on the entrepreneurial side and this macro environment? Like if you're an entrepreneur right now that has had to do layoffs or is facing business uncertainty, I guess any advice that you would give to those people?
I'd say make sure your costs are in control. That's first and foremost. Make sure, obviously, you have enough capital. Don't get yourself over-leveraged because, you know, sooner or later, you got to pay the piper. It will turn. I mean, you have to take the attitude if you've got a good, solid concept and you've got decent economics that this market will turn. The IPO market will come back. It just always does. Valuations will go up again. But I think I would urge an entrepreneur who's raising money or who needs capital to be realistic and forget about what they thought were valuations in 22 or 21 and not spend a lot of their time digging down a rabbit hole to, you know, raise money at unrealistic valuations. And that's more important than anything else, is get the money, get it quicker, and get back to what you're doing instead of trying to live in what the euphoria of the last couple of years, because I think we're going to be in a very, you know, I don't want to say monochromatic, but I think the world I see it in 22, I don't see dramatic recovery. I don't see the underpinnings to create that. But that's not all bad. I mean, you know, you always need a kind of digestion period and resetting, and that's what we're going through, I think, in 23.
Well, the legendary Alan Patricoff, thanks for doing this. This was fun. Everyone, your book is on sale everywhere you want to buy, Amazon.
I read it myself on Audible.
Oh, you did? Yes. I actually listened to part of it on Audible as well. Oh. So, yes, you can get it wherever books are sold. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for doing this. A life well lived and a lot of interesting insights. So thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
So that'll do it for the 50th episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. Thank you, Alan Patricoff, for joining and such an entertaining conversation. Hope everyone has a good weekend and look forward to seeing you here next week on the 51st episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. Have a nice weekend, everyone.